I'd like to begin the sermon today with a story, and this is a story that involved my grandson, and it leads into what we're going to talk about today. My grandson was playing ball, and after one ball game, we went to the Dairy Queen, and so we got my grandson an ice cream, and so we all were sitting down, and he got his ice cream and was walking over to where we were going to sit down and enjoy an ice cream cone. So what happened was he's going over there with his ice cream cone. Next thing you know, all of the ice cream in his cone fell on the floor. So being a 7-year-old boy, he just collapsed and fell on the floor. And his words, I'll always remember, "My life is so hard." Just, if you can imagine, the 7-year-old boy is just despondent. You know, and if you've dealt with children, and children will just, you know, once you say no or they don't get their way, they lay their head down on the ground, and I always looked at it as the death blow, the end of the world. So for him, that was the end of the world, and we kind of chuckled at his saying that my life is so hard. And he came up. We said, you know, probably when he's older and he looks back, he's going to say, that probably wasn't the most momentous event and most difficult event in my life. But from a 7-year-old boy's perspective, that's a big event. And the mindset there is interesting. It's the mindset of a young person like that, where they see it as the end of the world. And that particular mindset is not something that you just find in young children. It's something that you find in adults as well. There are adults who come to that conclusion, this is the end of the world, and they're overwhelmed by their circumstances. And so we have some examples in the Bible that we're going to look at today of people who became overwhelmed, not because they dropped their ice cream, but because there were much more serious issues that were being faced. So in light of that, I've entitled my sermon, "Everything, Life is So Hard, Everything is Against Me." Life is so hard, everything is against me. And I'd like to just look at three individuals. We're not going to go into detail on every one, but we'll look at some things about them and what was happening and the conclusion that they came to about where they were in life. The first one is Job. Job seems a natural one that we would go to because of the difficulties that he faced in his life. Job chapter 1 describes Satan coming before God, and God made use of Satan, and he made use of him in the time of Job, and he continues to make use of Satan at times in our lives because he can use Satan as a tool for our growth and our development. So Satan came before God, and God asked Satan if he had considered his servant Job. So he's pointing Job out. And Satan scoffingly says, "Why would anyone be surprised about Job walking in your ways when you bless him and in so many ways?" You're blessing him. Why would he not support you and worship you and honor you? Why would that be unusual? And so God challenges Satan in Job chapter 1, verse 9. It says, "So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face.'" So that's Satan's perspective on human beings. He has no respect for you, and the only reason that you would honor or worship God is because God is giving you goodies. And if God cuts off your goodies, you will curse him. You will no longer worship him. And so this is taking place with Job, and Job does not know what's going on. He can't see beyond the world and his physical life. So we are given insight into what's going on as God helps us to see that God's in charge and he's controlling this and he's actually using Satan in order to accomplish something he wants to accomplish in Job's life. So what's Job's reaction after being wiped out financially, after having his family wiped out? Job chapter 1, verse 20. Then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head in mourning over the death of his children. That was no small thing. It was a big thing in his life, but it wasn't going to totally derail him. So he had right and proper mourning over the death of his family. And he fell to the ground and worshiped. So he didn't turn from God. He was mourning, but he fell to the ground and worshiped God. And he had a pretty mature attitude about this, as we see in Job chapter 1, verse 21. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin, nor charge God with wrong. In losing all of his material goods and his family, he held up pretty well. He didn't turn against God. He didn't curse God. He continued to honor and worship God. So he did not come to the conclusion at this point in his life that everything is against him and life is very hard. He didn't come to that conclusion. So the next stage of Job's trials begins when Job allows Satan to attack Job, his physical person. Satan inflicts terrible boils on him, painful weeping boils from head to toe. Chapter 2, verse 7 of Job. Job chapter 2, verse 7. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And Job was taking a broken pot, a piece of a broken pot, and using that pot to scrape himself, to scrape off all of the ooze that was coming from his body. He did the scraping while he sat in the midst of the ashes. And Job's wife observed this, and Job observed how miserable he was, and she said, "Look, just curse God and die." But Job refused to do that. But Job did find this situation he was in to be a great struggle, because he tells us in Job chapter 3, verse 11, Job chapter 3, verse 11. He looks at his situation. He realizes the pain that he is in, and it is very difficult for him. And he says, beginning in verse 11, "Why did I not die at birth? Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? Why did the knees receive me? Or why the breast that I should nurse? For now I would have lain still and been quiet. If I were dead, I wouldn't be going through this." I'm better off dead, is what he's saying. I'm better off dead. So, and then he says, I would have been asleep, and then I would have been at rest. So he recognized that if you're dead, you're resting, and you're not going through the pain that he was going through, and he wished that that was the situation with him. But that wasn't God's will or God's purpose. And Job's conclusion here is, life is so hard and everything is against me. He feels he's being unfairly treated by God, and he wants his day in court. And he has his friends come over and visit with him. And basically they all tell him what they believe the problem is, when they really don't understand the problem from God's point of view. So they're not encouraging or helpful at all. I mean, their conclusion is, the only reason this is happening, Job, is because you have done something that offended God. And you're getting what you deserve as a result of that. And as you look at the story, there's no indication that Job did anything that caused God to inflict this terrible pain on him. There's something else going on, and there is an issue, of course, that God wants Job to understand, but it's not because he sinned. It's because he had things to learn, and God wanted him to learn them, and this was the way that would do it. But Job came to the conclusion, my life is so hard, and everything is against me. So as Job's friends talked to him, they were not helpful at all. The only one that came and did and was helpful was Elihu, and he spoke last. And basically he said, he focused on the fact of God's wisdom, God's authority, God's power, and that these things are all realities. And Job, you have to always keep that in mind. Don't lose sight of that. And these realities point to the fact that we must be faithful to God at all times. Because God doesn't change. And if God doesn't change and God is involved in your life, then you need to continue to have faith in that. And basically, as you think about God's faithfulness, God's faithful every day. He's faithful all day long, no matter whether things are going well in your life or not. So eventually, you know, Job wanted his day in court, and God finally says, okay, you're going to have your chance. So we're going to spend some time in the courtroom. And, you know, Job thought, I've got a killer case. God has no justification for doing this. So when I lay it out to God, God's going to heal me immediately and we're going to move on with life. But Job didn't understand God or what God was doing. In Job chapter 42, beginning in Job 38, God talks to Job and he goes through all of these, the power and the wonders that God has, and just basically diminishes Job, saying, you talk big, but you don't get it. You don't understand the bigger picture and my might and power. I could heal you at any time, but there's a reason I haven't chosen to do that. In Job chapter 42, verse 2, it says, I know that you can do everything. So Job's finally beginning to see what God has the power to do, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore, I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer. So God basically asked Job a series of questions. Verse 5, I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, so my understanding was limited. I'd heard about you, but I didn't see you. And then he says, therefore I abhor myself and repent in ashes, dust and ashes. So he didn't see it. He didn't get what God was up to and God, why God was allowing this to occur. Finally, Job acknowledged that God was just in allowing him to suffer physically. God was just in what he had inflicted on him. And he looked at God and he says, you know what you're doing. I don't. I don't know what I'm talking about, and I know you understand exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it. And Job could see the greatness and power and wisdom of God working in his life, that God was working something that he was beyond what he could see and understand. So humanly, Job could say, "Life, my life is so hard. Everything is against me," but that is humanity talking. That's a self-pitying conclusion. Job, at the end of his ordeal in confrontation by God, saw how limited and powerless he was in comparison to God. And as he was humbled, then he began to see and understand what God was doing. He didn't understand the whole perspective, but he knew that God was in his life, that God was working in his life. And the only reason that this had taken place is because God was allowing it. That God had intervened in some way to bring these things into his life, all this suffering and all this pain. And he began to see that God was working out something that was crucial to his eternal life. So he did not understand every facet of it, but he did understand God was just in what he was doing. And so by the end of the ordeal, he began to understand something that we'll talk about here in a few minutes after we look at the other individuals who've gone through similar situations. Let's move on now to another person who had this life is so hard mindset, and that was Jacob. Jacob. And let's pick up the story in Genesis chapter 42, beginning in verse 36. Genesis 42, beginning in verse 36. So, and what's happened here is Jacob's sons have returned, but Joseph has been lost, and Simeon has been made to stay behind in Egypt. The sons come back, and they tell Jacob, their father, the only way that we can go back is if we take Benjamin. And Jacob doesn't handle that very well. And Jacob says, beginning in verse 36 of Genesis 42, "You have bereaved me. Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, and you want to take Benjamin? All these things are against me." As he examined his life at that point, the only thing that he saw was the difficulty that he was facing. Everything was against him. So he comes to a most negative conclusion. So he's struggling with this. Why is he going through this? And he doesn't want to lose more children. So you guys aren't going back down there. He said, if I sent you down and sent Benjamin along with you and he died, it would basically bring me down to the grave. So this was difficult for Jacob, and as it would be for any of us as human beings to lose a child. That's hard. And he thought, I've lost two sons and I'm going to lose more, especially my most beloved son at that time, Benjamin. So Jacob's conclusion in all of this was, life was hard and everything is against me. And I think we all come to that point sometimes based upon the things that we face, the adversities, the deprivations, the sacrifices that we have to make. And it's hard. It's not easy. And sometimes it seems overwhelming. And as you think about Jacob, Jacob is making the statement that everything is against him. But is that true? As you examine Jacob's life before this event where Simeon is made to stay in the land, had Jacob's life been that bad, that difficult? Had God blessed him? Had he, you know, as you think about him, had he entirely forgotten the one who appeared to him at Bethel? I mean, there's Jacob running for his life because his brother Esau wants to kill him. So he rests, and as he's laying there, he has this dream, and there are angels going up and down this ladder, and God's at the top of the ladder. And God makes a great promise to him. How many of us have had that happen? But none of that mattered in the present circumstance. He had forgotten that. Genesis chapter 28, verses 13 through 15. Let's read those verses where God speaks to Jacob as he's there and running away, running for his life up to live with his uncle Laban. Genesis 28, verse 13. "And behold, the Lord stood above it," that is the ladder, "and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants." So this is a promise that is ultimately going to be fulfilled of Jacob receiving all the land that's yet to come. "Also, your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth." You're going to have a massive number of descendants. "You shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and the south." Yes, you're going to have a vast number of descendants, and they're going to spread out in all directions. "And in you and in your seed, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." And the greatest promise of all is that one of your descendants is going to be the one that offers salvation to all mankind. "Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you." So Jacob went out. He stayed with his uncle Laban, went through hard times with him, and God eventually brought him back to the land, just as he had promised. And let's just see what God says about fulfilling that promise in Genesis chapter 31. Genesis chapter 31, beginning in verse 36. Genesis chapter 31, verse 36. So this is an incident that takes place when Jacob has fled from his father-in-law's household. He and his family are headed back to the land of promise. Laban goes after him and catches up to him. And Jacob is angry when he talks to Laban. He says, Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? Although you have searched all my things," and Laban was looking for his gods, and Jacob did not know that his wife Rachel had taken the household gods, but they searched everything and they didn't find it. "What part of your household things have you found? Set it here before my brethren and your brethren that they may judge between us both. These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young. So since I've come into your household, you've been blessed. Your flocks have grown in number." And he says that, "And I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beast I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was in the day the drought consumed me and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. It was tough. I was your servant, and I made sacrifice for you and suffered as a consequence." He said that, "Thus I have been in your house 20 years. I have served you 14 for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock. And you have changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." So Jacob had to admit that he was blessed. But in the midst of the circumstances of losing his boys and potentially losing another, did not look at any of this. And these things were realities that he didn't look upon. And as Jacob and his family drew near the land of Canaan, Jacob knew that when he left the land, that his brother Esau wanted him dead. And Esau had committed himself to killing Jacob once his father Isaac died. And Jacob realized this and he said, "I gotta go." So off he went. And Jacob brought some of his troubles on himself, but he realized his brother was seeking his life. But as Jacob came back to the land, he found that his brother had forgiven him. He didn't hold a grudge, and he was not seeking his death any longer. And then something amazing happened. Jacob was an unconverted man when he left. And through all of the sufferings that he went through, when he returned, he was a different person. And God came to test him, and he did so by wrestling with him. Because Jacob was the type of person who is an opportunist, and he would take advantage of any opportunity to gain a leg or a foot up on somebody else. So God said, "Okay, let's see what you're made of. Have you developed character? Are you ready to continue this path of life and to walk before me faithfully?" So he wrestled with Jacob. And Jacob usually would have quit because it was too hard. But Jacob had grown in character and maturity, and he wouldn't give in. And God blessed him. And God changed his name to Israel. Just as when God changed Abram's name to Abraham. But these were all realities going on in Jacob's life, but he didn't see them. But with the loss of Joseph and the potential loss of Benjamin, Jacob focused on the immediate circumstances. And his conclusion was, "Life is hard. Everything is against me." So he had lost sight of the full picture, that there was more to the story than that. And I suspect at this point that Jacob might protest that he didn't mean to say exactly what he said. And his protest was meant along slightly different lines. But he still said it. It was hard for him. And have we ever said something akin to, "Life is hard. Everything is against me. My life is hopeless. I would be better off to be dead." Have we ever said those things? Sometimes we feel hopeless. We see no way out. And we can come to this conclusion. And I think that we all at various times face these things, depending on what we do face in our lives. These are just things that we face as human beings. A final example I'd like to look at is Elijah, the prophet Elijah. When, you know, there came a point in Elijah's life that where he felt the same way. But if you look at Elijah's life, God greatly blessed and used Elijah. And tremendous miracles were done through Elijah in order to help Israel to come to repentance. And the Bible recounts various miracles that took place in Elijah's life. I mean, how many of us, as they send out an army to bring us in to the king, we call down fire from heaven? I don't think any of us have done that. Never had that experience. But Elijah did. You know, God provided for him miraculously with the ravens to bring him food. And God used him to pronounce a curse on the land for 3 years. It's not going to rain for that period of time. And it didn't. And life got very difficult. So then came the ultimate confrontation during this time of drought in the land. Elijah made a deal with the king, and he said, let's get together. You get the prophets of Baal together. I will come. We'll gather on the mountain, and we will set up two altars, and we'll see who is God. And like he tells them, why halt between two opinions? Who is God? Who is God, Baal or the God that's been revealed in the Bible? So they set up these two altars, and they set stones there. They gather the wood. They have the offerings, but there's no fire. And the fire is to be supplied by the God who is the true God. So Elijah says, okay, you guys have at it. He tells the 400 priests of Baal, you guys go first. You know, so have at it. So they did. So they're going through this whole process of chanting and running around and cutting themselves and all of the things that they did in order to get Baal's attention and ask him to catch everything on fire. And so Elijah let him go for a while, and they went and they went and they went, and Elijah took the opportunity to mock them to a degree, you know, and I think, where is Baal? Is he out? Is he on vacation? Where is he? And their God never answered. And in 1 Kings 18, verse 27, it says, and so it was at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he is a God. Either he is meditating, or he is busy, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he's sleeping and must be awakened. And eventually, the priest couldn't get the job done. Couldn't get it done, so it became Elijah's turn. So Elijah set everything up, and he had them get water and pour it on the altar. And then he said, he made this short prayer to God, and God zapped the offering, and it was consumed. And everybody knew who is God but the God of the Bible. And then Elijah said, you've seen what the true God can do. So he said, let's end this false worship by killing the prophets of Baal. So they killed the 400 prophets of Baal. And so it's the greatest triumph you could imagine happening with Elijah. And then what happens? Then Jezebel gets wind of what's taken place, and she sends out a letter, you're dead. You're dead. And you know, from Elijah's perspective here, I've been part of this great miracle, this astounding miracle which everybody has seen, and now she's threatening to kill me. Where's Aren't you going to watch out for me? Aren't you going to stand up for me, God? So what does Elijah do? He runs for it. He runs for it. And there's no indication that he said, God, you blessed me with in the situation with the prophets of Baal. You won't bless me now? And trusting God, his faith faltered and he made a run for it. Let's pick up the story of Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 10. 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 10. So he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts. And he had been. For the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. This was his perspective. But as you look at Elijah, did he see the whole picture? We'll find out here shortly. Did he see the whole picture? Yes, he had stood up for God, and God had protected him. God had provided for him. So why was God going to change now, as his life was threatened? And Elijah goes on to say in chapter 19, verse 14, 1 Kings 19, verse 14, he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts because the children of Israel have forsaken God. And he saw himself as alone. But was he alone? So he ran for it and was seeking to avoid being killed. And what was his conclusion in 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 4? So he ran toward the Sinai Desert, toward Mount Horeb. And the next thing we find is that he's in a cave. 1 Kings 19, verse 4, it says, But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree and prayed that he might die and said, It is enough now, Lord. Take my life, for I am no better than my fathers. I'm better off dead. Same conclusion that Job came to in his challenge. And Elijah said the same thing. And he forgot the good things and the miraculous things that God had done and said, I'm all alone. But was he all alone as you look at it? He couldn't see it. Was he all alone? Look at what God reveals to Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 18. Elijah's perception was that he was all alone, that there were no faithful left. 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 18. It says, Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel. You don't know it, Elijah, but I still have 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal and every mouth that has not kissed him. So Elijah did not understand this. And you might think about it someday in the future if you feel like, you know, I'm all alone. There aren't any Christians left. It's just me. I've served God faithfully. Where are all these other faithful people? I'd be careful about concluding that God doesn't have any other people following his way of life, because we don't see the whole picture as God does. Let's look at, and to help us better understand this, look at the example of Elisha. Elisha, who became the prophet to Israel after Elijah was taken up by God and moved elsewhere. And Elisha and his servant were at Dothan. And the reason that, and what they had is the whole city surrounded by armies. There was war with Syria, and Elisha would tell the king of Israel, hey, here's what the king of Syria is going to do. It was like they had a spy in the tent where plans were made. But God revealed the plans to Elisha, and then Elisha would share them with the king. So they said, well, we've got to get Elisha. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to find a place where Elisha was holed up, and then they could surround the city and they could capture him. And they are in the city of Dothan. Elisha is there with his servant, and his servant goes out in the morning and he looks over the city wall and he sees the whole city surrounded by the Syrian army. And he's thinking, how are we going to get out of this? I don't think we're going to get out. So he comes to Elisha and tells him how terrible this is, what a predicament they're in. And let's pick up the story in 2 Kings 6, verse 14. 2 Kings 6, verse 14. There it says, therefore he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night and surrounded the city. And when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, alas, master, what shall we do? So Elisha answered, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. You know, looking at it physically, would that be your conclusion? And he said, do not fear. And Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So physically, he couldn't see that there was any hope in the situation. How was God going to get him out of this? And Elisha said, note, there are more angelic beings in that host out there than people surrounding this city. And God did bless them, and the army was actually captured and returned without any warfare through the might and the power of God. You look at Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ in John chapter 16, verse 32. John 16, verse 32. Jesus was a man and experienced the trials and troubles that we have. And he says in chapter 16 of John, verse 32, indeed, the hour is coming, yes, has now come, that you will be scattered, each to his own, and will leave me alone. Yes, you're going to be scattered as my disciples. You're going to leave me alone. And Christ had the wisdom to see, had the insight to see. He said, and yet I am not all alone, not alone, because the Father is with me. So as you think about your life and my life, aren't we like Christ in the sense that God is with us? These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. So we may have a feeling where we're all alone. There is no way out, it seems. But God said, you know what? I'm with you. I'm with you, and I'll see you through. Let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. And something that we must always keep in mind as we go through things like this. There are times when it seems we're very alone. It seems there's no way out. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 31. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 31. And there it says, for the Lord your God is a merciful God, and thankfully he is. He will not forsake you, nor destroy you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers which he swore to them. Have we entered into covenant with God? Did God swear as he entered into covenant with you and me? And we can have confidence that God will never leave us nor forsake us. He's always there. We can't see him. We may not know everything. We don't know how something's going to work out, but he is there with us, and he will see us through. I think that as I was thinking about this and preparing for the sermon, I thought about one of my favorite scriptures that sometimes it's always in the Bible, but do we always remember it? And we should. When we face adversity, when we reach the conclusion of our life that there's no way out, there's no hope, I can't bear this, I'm all alone, and there is no way out. Look at Romans 8, verse 28, a verse that we know, but do we think about? Romans 8, verse 28. There it says in verse 28, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God." It doesn't say some things. It says all things work together for good to those who love God. So it says that no matter what circumstance you find yourself in, if you're prospering, then all things are going to work out for your good. If things aren't going well, the same point is true. All things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. So that's always true. If things are going well or not so well, that's always true, that all things are going to work together for your blessing and benefit. It was true for Job, it was true for Jacob, it was true for Elijah, and it's true for you and me. So as you face trials in your life, is this where you go to? You can't see the big picture. You can't see how it's going to work out, but do you have the confidence that all things work together for good in your life? And whoever you know that's facing difficulty. And I think that we, as Christians, need to think about this, and I don't always think of this. I don't always think, well, all things work together for good to those who are called according to His purpose. But I don't always see that or think about that. All I'm thinking about is this is terrible. My ice cream's fallen off my cone. Life is so hard. It's hopeless. Where do I go? This is not going to work out. And we can, as humans, begin to think like that. And it's something that we should avoid. This is a quote, not from the Bible, but from somebody that I came across. And the statement that they made about being grateful and thankful is interesting. It says, "The unthankful heart discovers no mercies." There's no hope. There isn't a merciful God who's going to work this out. So you're not thankful. You're just, my life is so hard, everything is against me, kind of a mindset. "The unthankful heart discovers no mercies. But let the thankful heart sweep through the day, and as a magnet finds the iron, so we will find in every hour some heavenly blessings." And that's from Henry Ward Beecher. So anyway, he said, you know, if you are thankful and you have that mindset of being thankful, for good or bad, and you try to find the mercy in it, you're going to be attracted to that, and you're going to find it. Think about Jeremiah. Jeremiah faced more than his fair share of adversity and had seen the fall of Judah to the Babylonians, and Jeremiah did say, "I'd be better off dead." He went through hard times. But look this is after the fall of Jerusalem and all of the devastation that took place then. And the prophet Jeremiah says the following in Lamentations chapter 3, verse 31. Lamentations 3, verse 21. And I'm going to read this in the Living Bible because I think it just makes it gives it a little bit more positive emphasis. It says, "Yet there is one ray of hope." And that's true every day. No matter how hard things are, there is a ray of hope. Verse 22, "His compassion never ends." Speaking of God. "His compassion never ends. It is only the Lord's mercies that have kept us from complete destruction." God is a merciful God, and God has a plan that He's working out with you and me, and regardless of how difficult the problems are, He's still working it out. And whatever we're going through is all part of that process. It's something we need to go through. Doesn't mean it's fun, but God is allowing it to come our way for our growth and development. And He says, "Great is His faithfulness. His loving kindness begins afresh each day." It begins afresh each day. My soul claims the Lord as my inheritance. Therefore, I will hope in him. The Lord is wonderfully good to those who wait for him, to those who seek for him. It is good both to hope and wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord, because it will come. It will come. So do we recall God's mercies every day? So when things aren't going well, do we think of Romans 8, verse 28, all things work together? Do we think of that? Because it's true every day. From the time you wake up until the time you go to bed and all through the night, God is faithful. God is there, and God will never leave you nor forsake you. And I'd like to end with an article I came across in thinking about Thanksgiving and reading about it, and make a suggestion in regard to expanding our expressions of gratefulness, not just to God, but to other people. We should always be grateful to God and offer him thanks daily. So here's the article, and it mentions Christmas at the beginning, but the Christmas part of it is irrelevant. Okay. During this past Christmas season, and this is somebody in the church, a discussion on the radio that we listened to during the drive to work each morning focused on sending thank you cards for Christmas presents. One of the hosts said that she had been taught to do so by her mother, while the other contended that it would be ridiculous to send them. At this point, about the same time, my wife and I became aware of a book entitled A Simple Act of Gratitude. Anybody heard of that book? Okay. So I hadn't until I read this, by John Kralik, a Los Angeles County Superior Court judge. Mr. Kralik has revealed an extremely important aspect of gratefulness, that expressing great thankfulness is absolutely essential, even vital. The word thank means to express gratitude for a favor and to acknowledge and to extend acknowledgments to one for kindness bestowed. And going on, it says, many research studies have recognized a correlation between gratitude and increased well-being, and not just for the one expressing thanks, but for everyone involved. Those who advocate positive psychology have taken these studies to heart and have begun to incorporate exercises to increase gratitude. Writing thank you letters is being prescribed. It has been found that what works best in the short term is a gratitude visit, where a person writes and delivers a letter of gratitude to someone in his life. The longest lasting outcome comes after writing a gratitude journal, where the individual writes down three things he is grateful for today. People who are more grateful just feel better about themselves. They are happier, less stressed, and more satisfied with their lives and relationships. They feel more in control of their surroundings, personal growth, and purpose in life. Thankful people employ more positive ways of coping with the trials of life. They sleep better at night because they think fewer negative thoughts and more positive ones just before nodding off. Judge Kralik's book rests on similar principles. He contends that the law of reciprocity, which posits that what a person does will return to him, prevails in the act of expressing thanks. And I'm not talking about karma, okay? Karma is not a biblical principle at all. But the principle of giving is. And a couple of verses that just point to that, beginning in Luke chapter 6, verse 37. And I'll just read this passage to you, beginning in Luke chapter 6, verse 37. It says, judge not, and you shall not be judged. So you're careful about judging, thinking about other people. You're not so harsh. Well, he did this to me, and he owes me this. Judge not, and you shall not be judged. And there is a judging that's acceptable. It's not judging in the sense that you're going straight to the lake of fire. You don't know that. But judging what he did is wrong or not right. But you don't judge harshly because you want God to exercise the same level of judgment that would come in your direction. Here Luke says, condemn not, and you shall not be condemned. Forgive, and you shall be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. That's a fundamental principle of Christianity. That as you give, it has a tendency to come back to you. So are we all going to start giving because I know I'm going to get more stuff? That's not what it's talking about. You know, you, in essence, cast your bread on the waters, hoping there will be a return, but there may not be. And if you don't get a return, that doesn't matter. You still did what was right and pleasing to God. Getting back to this article, it says, Kralik writes about the miserable position that he found himself in one December day. His law firm was losing money and its lease. Not only that, he was also in the midst of a difficult divorce, and he was completely out of funds. He was living in a small, stuffy apartment, often sleeping on the floor to escape the heat. The sons had grown distant from him. He could only see an even worse year ahead. Originally, he had high expectations for his life. Yet they had all long since fallen by the wayside during his pursuit of financial stability, which he had clearly failed to achieve. So as you look at this guy, everything is going down the drain, and he has no way out of it. None. His situation is hopeless. So, in the book, he recounts the lesson that his grandfather had tried to teach him when he was a boy of five. His grandfather had given him a shiny new silver dollar and had promised that if he wrote him a letter thanking him for it, he would give him one another one. So, that's the way thank you letters work, his grandfather told him. Sure enough, once little John wrote him the letter of thanks, he received a second silver dollar. But John failed to learn the lesson very well. He never sent a second thank you letter because he would have gotten another silver dollar. And so his grandfather never sent him a third one. He got one, sent the letter, and got two, but he never did it a third time. As he walked, and this guy's down in the dumps and feeling that all is lost, his life is hopeless, and everything is against me, my life is so hard. He was walking along a hiking trail in the mountains above Pasadena, California, in the midst of despair, and he claims to have heard a voice. I'm not sure about that, but he claims to have heard a voice that said, until you learn to be grateful for what you have, you will not receive the things you want. And he definitely wasn't a grateful person. So, well, he decided immediately that he would embark on a campaign for sending thank you notes to 365 people during the course of the next year. And he spends the rest of the book describing the thank you notes, the occasions for them, and the results of having sent them. Of course, things turn out for the better immediately. Clients begin paying long overdue bills. His practice gains new clients. A new office space presents itself, and perhaps best of all, his sons are suddenly eager for a renewed relationship. He experiences a transformation from the self-absorbed ingrate to a joyful, grateful, positive person. And this isn't a straight line. It goes through, and he wanted to go back to being an ingrate. Okay, so I mean, there were times when I don't want to write a note. I've written enough notes and all of this. He had trouble staying on that path. For instance, if you make a commitment to write 365 thank you notes over the next year, will you be able to do it? Will you stick with it for the whole time? So he experiences this transformation from being a self-absorbed ingrate to a joyful, grateful, positive person. To top it all off, he winds up as a superior court judge, something he had always dreamed about becoming. Now he is happy, successful, and grateful, a grateful man who continues to write letters of thanks on every occasion. He also keeps a journal of the kind acts and thank you notes which he rejoices in revisiting. So he realized that the condition was in. He was miserable. And he decided, I need to be grateful and express that gratefulness even though I don't have anything. So he began doing that. For instance, he began giving the employees who worked in his law office thank you notes. Okay? And he wasn't very appreciative of those people. So what he did is he's giving them notes, and what happened was he was shocked because his employees thought well of him, and they all started writing him notes. One situation, he had a bank that was a client. And the bank was going down the tubes. This is around 2007, 2008. So it's going down the tubes, and he knows they're eventually going to run out of money, but he has appreciated them being a client. He appreciated them, the things that they've done for them. So what did he do? He sent a thank you note to the person who sent the checks. So the person contacted him and said in all of his life, he had never received a thank you note like that from a lawyer, especially the evil lawyers. But he said, I'd never received a note like that. So guess what happened? When they're on the brink of going under, who do you think sent him money to pay his bills? You don't think they remembered that? They did. And so anyway, he started doing this, and it was interesting, the results in his life, because it changed the way that he looked at life. It's easy for us to go through life and say, say in my mind, I appreciate them giving me that gift. Or, I appreciate the work that they did for me. It's easy to think it. Just one example. But what happens is you can think it, but then doing something about it is a different case. For instance, I took all this stuff about this camp stuff that I needed to send to the person who's taking over for me. And it's a huge pile of stuff, and I had it in a box, and I'm standing there, and it's going to cost over $20 to send all this, which was fine. But she said, she offered, I didn't ask, is there a better way? She said, this stuff will go in one of these mailing boxes produced by the post office, it's only going to cost you $14. So I thought, let's give it a go. So she suggested this. The evil, hard to get along with male people. She suggested it. We stuffed it all in that box. She said, you can put in up to 70 pounds. I thought, okay, let's go. So we stuffed it all in there in an organized way, so it was all going to get there. And you know what? It was $14, not over 20. But she didn't have to do that. She could have just said, who cares? Let him go ahead and pay that. But she was thoughtful, which I thought, that's pretty unusual. That's not how I think of the post office. And I thought, on the spot, I need to thank this lady. But you know what? I never did. I never did. You can think it, but thinking it doesn't get it done. So you've got to make the effort, and as you make that effort to be thankful, you may say, well, I can't write very well. My writing is illegible. Who cares? You make the effort and do your best to write that note out and pass it along. I have a dermatologist who worked on my cancer, and she's a very fine person. So I thought, I ought to thank her. Guess what? I've thought about it, but I've never done it. And that's just us as human beings. We don't do it. But as you begin to that process of trying to look for things to be thankful for, and you begin to take action on the things that you're thankful for, and we're always thankful to God because God is the giver of every good gift, isn't he? So we automatically think of him, but to think of other people who've treated us with kindness, that will make a difference in our lives. Now, I started thinking about this, and not that I've been an ingrate, probably I've been an ingrate more than not. But anyway, in just beginning to think about this and how I would implement this has helped me to begin to see all things work together for good and to begin to look at things in a more positive way. Not to collapse in a heap, I lost my ice cream cone, it's the end of the world. No, but to try to take a more pure, mature approach to things. So, anyway, as we see here, I think it's a biblical principle, and nobody has to do this. I'm just suggesting it. And just do it and see what happens. So I'm going to do it, and from time to time, I'll tell you what happens. But my point is, I would encourage you in the next year to offer up expressions of gratitude to God each day, of course. He's the giver of every good gift. And I imagine many of us do this regularly, and we should. But it might be worthwhile to, as you go through your day, begin to think about people that you should thank and be grateful for. And see what happens. See what happens. Will there be a positive thing? You know, your boss does something good for you. How often are the employees saying, you know, you're a great boss, I appreciate what you do, or, you know, you do some things good, but don't bring up the negative stuff, but you try to be positive toward him. You think he's getting lots of those notes? He's not. But you begin to think of other people and look for ways to thank them. And do it. So I'm going to give it my best shot. I want to avoid that life is so hard and everyone and everything is against me, because that conclusion is wrong. Because we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to his purpose. And God extends new mercies to us every day. And this book is called A Simple Act of Gratitude. It's not expensive. It's an easy read. And there's some parts of it that I really found most enjoyable. This guy that wrote the book, John Kralik, had a daughter, and so he doesn't live with him all the time. And they live in this dumpy apartment in Sierra Madre. And so she lived with him, and she was always happy. He'd pick her up from school. He was in the dumps. She was always happy. That's a delightful part of the book. Another part of it, just read the book. It's worth your time. You can probably read it in 2 days, but it is positive. And I got myself a gratitude journal. So anyway, I'm going to start doing this here. I started my first note. I wrote my first note on Thanksgiving. I wrote it to the person I'm most thankful for. And she asked me, well, why didn't you get me one of these? So, still being an ingrate. But anyway, I did order her one after she mentioned that she would like one too. So I got one for her. But the thing is, you know, we as human beings, we go through life. Just take time to think of other people, to send them a note. It doesn't have to be a long note. But why you appreciate them, why you're thankful for them. You know, you look at the difficulties the person had with his sons, and they were estranged. And he sent notes to them, and actually the wounds began to heal, and they began to interact once again. And his wife, who he was divorcing, he had all kinds of problems with her. But he noticed that his wife went to all this trouble to set up this birthday party for his daughter, and she got together all these different things that the kids could draw and make, and it really took a lot of work. And he noticed it, and so he sent a note to his wife saying what a wonderful job she did in providing this for his daughter. And he said what happened was she began treating him a little better. So people begin to respond to acts of kindness, because in this world, How many acts of kindness do you run into every day? Some, but many times you don't run into many. So the thing is, I hope you see, I hope as you feel like everything is against me, life is so hard, that you'll think about God is always with you and that all things work together for good. And that as you think about the good things, that you can thank other people for them. I'm going to give it a try. I hope you will too. And maybe we can talk about them at some point in the future. Just see what results have you got. So I'm going to try. We'll see if I make it a year. I would like to. And we'll see what happens. But as you develop that habit, it's something where you're more thankful and you're more conscious of it. So hopefully that'll be an edifying lesson and also give us some food for thought for the future. So thank you for your attention. Have a great remainder of the Sabbath.